Are you or is someone you know a marijuana smoker? Have you or is someone in your family been arrested for a marijuana violation? You need to know the truth about pot. NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, is the most comprehensive source of information regarding marijuana and its effects on health, as well as legal issues. NORML even offers a database of lawyers specializing in cannabis in your area. NORML, the nation's largest and most successful marijuana law reform organization, has spent decades gathering the knowledge and science on everything related to cannabis. NORML is the best resource to find out the truth about marijuana, connect with a lawyer in your area, or help find an end to prohibition. Information is available at normal.org, that's NORML.org, or toll free at 888-67-NORMAL. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Daily Audio Stash is where responsible marijuana smokers listen in on the latest news about cannabis, hear the voices of the marijuana law reform movement in special segments and interviews, and kick back with comedy and music no other podcast can offer. It's NORML's Daily Audio Stash. More information at normalaudiostash.com. First up today, it's news from NORML. Our news today. San Diego's supervisors announced their intent to appeal Superior Court ruling. The San Diego County Board of Supervisors voted Tuesday 4-1 to appeal a judge's recent decision to reject the county's controversial challenge to California's decade-old Proposition 215 Compassionate Use Act. The county sued the state of California and NORML's San Diego affiliate over a 2004 requirement that counties issue identification cards for medical marijuana users. San Bernardino and Merced counties also joined the suit. The county's lawsuit argues that both Proposition 215 and the state's medical marijuana ID card program should be preempted by the Federal Controlled Substances Act. Last week, Superior Court Judge William R. Nevitt Jr. ruled that county officials would not be breaking federal law by giving out the state identification cards. In his opinion, Nevitt declared that the state's 10-year-old medical marijuana law is legal because it does not, quote, require, close quote, conduct that violates federal law. Nevitt also rejected plaintiffs' challenge to California's 3-year-old medical ID card program, ruling that, quote, requiring the counties to issue identification cards for the purpose of identifying those whom California chooses not to arrest and prosecute for certain activities involving marijuana does not create a positive conflict with federal law. Nevitt also ruled that in some cases, states' laws are, quote, supreme, close quote, over federal law. 55% of California voters approved Proposition 215 in a 1996 vote, but marijuana users in California, even those fully regulated by the state under Proposition 215, are still prosecuted under federal drug laws by federal agents. 10 other states have adopted measures protecting qualified medical marijuana patients from prosecution. Alaska, Colorado, Hawaii, Maine, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Washington. The San Diego lawsuit is the only legal challenge ever presented to any of the medical marijuana laws, and all sides admit the case may have national implications. Stay tuned to the Audio Stash this week as we continue to cover this important story. You can read the Superior Court ruling and other information regarding Proposition 215 with links we have at normalaudiostash.com. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today, I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit NORML.org. First up today, we have our weekly conversation with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Each Wednesday here on the Audio Stash, we get the chance to discuss the science of marijuana with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Mitch is professor of psychology at State University of New York. He's author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book Pot Politics. We have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com. Mitch, welcome back to the Audio Stash today.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Mitch, today we're going to discuss a very juicy topic, sex and marijuana. The ONDCP and DEA would have us believe that smoking marijuana decreases sex drive, yet we hear from Carl Sagan and Ann Dryan that their best sexual experience happened after smoking pot. So, let's cut to the chase here. Does smoking marijuana affect your sex drive?
As it turns out, we don't have a lot of data addressing actual desire, and we do have tons and tons of sort of informal clinical reports where people say sex is certainly enhanced during or right after marijuana use, and so it's hard to even entertain the idea that somehow your sex drive would drop with long-term use. Obviously, that's not something that's been a priority among a lot of big funding agencies, so if it does happen, we certainly haven't heard about it.
So when we hear about this anecdotal evidence, are people saying their experience is enhanced or their sex drive is better?
We've got data from as early as the 1980s suggesting that the experience is better. Men report seeing themselves as more giving and that people are generally more sensitive to touch, in part because time is distorted after smoking marijuana. People at least seem to think they spend a lot more time in the sex act. There's a lot of enhanced orgasm reports, both in Charlie Tart's data from 1971 all the way to like ancient Chinese things in 200 AD. So I think this is a pretty consistent effect and one that folks like to talk about. I do want to caution that cannabis is not a lubricant, and we do see a number of drying of mucous membranes, whether it's in your eye or anywhere else, that could be affected, and that's why I have to recommend that people keep that in mind if they're planning on sexual contact after using cannabis.
So that common cottonmouth effect of smoking marijuana isn't just from having the smoke pass over your palate, but it's drying up the body overall as part of the physical effects of marijuana intoxication.
In fact, all mucous membranes are drier after use, and that would be something to make investment in a lubricant worthwhile.
Mitch, you mentioned this sort of temporal shift when folks are smoking marijuana. Is that sense of spending more time having sex in and of itself enhancing the experience?
As it turns out, we don't have data directly addressing that, but it certainly makes a lot of intuitive sense. I think the other thing that we hear a lot is just there's really nice, candid discussions about what you like and what you don't like after cannabis that often don't occur when you're, either using alcohol or no substances at all. And I think more than anything, it's what are the occasions where this happens. So people often don't use cannabis before sex unless they know they're going to have enough time and they're going to be in a comfortable setting and they're in all these other situations that seem to contribute to good sexual performance as well. And so what I recommend to folks is if they want to use cannabis to enhance sex, that's great. But think about what are the other things that you're doing when you do that and see can you do those more often as well. I know parents of young children often find themselves in situations where they're tired and rushed, and what a surprise, it's not as good as things used to be. Well, if they could arrange to, get rest and find an environment where they could be uninterrupted for a longer period, that alone would contribute so much. And then if you want to use cannabis to enhance that further, by all means, go ahead.
And Mitch, using the media buzz phrase out there, what about sexual promiscuity? We have a lot of evidence that alcohol increases sexual promiscuity in men and women, but does that happen with cannabis intoxication?
We only have really two published studies suggesting any link between cannabis use and, say, condom use or having unprotected sex or things like that. And I think what happens is there's a subset of folks who are sort of disinhibited in general, sensation seekers, if you will. And so they do report using cannabis and having unsafe sex. We don't have a lot of data showing that it was actually the event when they used cannabis that also led to the unsafe sex. So we don't really know if it's causal so much as just a quality of a certain kind of person. Obviously, you know, with practice, anything like this can help. Does it lead to promiscuity? Well, people who use cannabis also have different attitudes about appropriate numbers of sexual partners, and it's not so much that cannabis leads to these things, but that these are things that correlate. People who enjoy cannabis may also have different ideas about how many sexual partners they should have in their lives or what level of commitment they have to have.
Let's also talk about one of the pop culture legends promoted by the ONDCP, and that is sterility in men. Mitch, can smoking or eating cannabis make a man sterile?
In fact, it's not a complete falsehood. Gabriel Nahas published some data on some men who were living in a hospital and smoked 8 joints a day for 8 days in a row, and their sperm counts did decrease. They didn't go down to the sterility level, and of course, they returned to normal when they were no longer using cannabis. So it's a temporary decrease in sperm count, and I guess, you know, if I had somebody coming to me saying we're having some fertility problems, I would recommend going off for a month or more just to give yourself the chance. But it's nowhere near birth control, and that's the thing that really worries me, is that there may be folks out there thinking that heavy cannabis use would be a good way to prevent conception, and that's just not the case at all.
And what about women? Is there anything that points to marijuana making women less able to conceive?
What's funny is the only data we have are from studies of women who were having fertility problems, and they do have some women in those samples who used cannabis, and they don't show any differences in their ability to conceive, but ironically, they're the ones who had sex more often. So we don't know if it's that they actually do have a lowered probability, but they're having so much sex that that makes up for it, or what. Really, really heavy, absurdly large doses of THC will interrupt estrus, the menstrual cycle, in apes and in certain other primates, but it's the dosages are just so high, it's a ridiculous comparison with humans and normal cannabis consumption.
So there's no way for a woman to smoke a dose of THC high enough to affect conception.
Exactly.
Also, Mitch, let's look at the other side of this. Is it good for our overall sexual health to be intoxicated every time we have sex?
I would not say so. I think the cool thing about sex and relationships is variety, in that sometimes something as simple as, you know, lying on the bed the other way or going into another room of your house can make all this difference. And then making sure that you really get the opportunity to talk about it, to praise your partner for the things you like. And it sometimes can be as simple as, you know, grunting and groaning a little bit more just to make sure that the message gets across what feels good. And suddenly you find you like this person more and you're much more willing to talk about both positive and negative things more. And the bottom line is, yeah, cannabis can enhance that, but, you know, once in a while is great. If you do it every time, of course, then it's not special anymore, and you end up kind of stuck in a rut as far as that goes.
I'm always amazed, Mitch, when we talk about people who smoke cannabis together, that we have better conversations and gain a deeper understanding of our partners and ourselves. It seems that cannabis is this wonderful catalyst for an at-home version of cognitive behavioral therapy.
Well, what's funny about that is we don't have the placebo control, so I think some couples may have the excuse of, oh, I was high, and can always take back anything they said. But in fact, a lot of folks report being able to share, you know, either feelings or stories of incidents that are really meaningful to them during the intoxication experience, either because they have the excuse of saying, oh, well, I was intoxicated, in case their partner has an adverse reaction, but also they just seem more willing to take risks as far as what they're willing to share, and you see that across a whole bunch of different domains. So, yeah, I think that that's a neat little adjunct to couples' cognitions and their sharing.
We also see in the media and in our spam email boxes the incessant push for erectile dysfunction drugs. I'm not sure how much of a widespread problem this is compared to the marketing. Many of these drugs promote blood flow, however. So can cannabis promote blood flow and thus help with erectile dysfunction?
I think the key on this is this weird United States focus on sex having to require a big, hard penis. That's just not the case. What a wonderful thing it would be to say sexual contact doesn't necessarily mean a certain act and only that one. And I think cannabis often loosens people up with their expectations about what sex has to require in order to happen. And then with that pressure off, yeah, maybe you're more likely to have standard erectile functioning under those circumstances, but also be open to the idea that you can have, you know, a lot of hugging and kissing and warm interaction and touching up against each other without the standards clinical definition of erection. The irony, too, is I think cannabis enhances sensation, and that's the source of erection we'd really like there to be, not some artificial trapping of blood in certain areas of the body. Yeah.
So, Mitch, do you think that American men really have this incredible rate of medical problems with their erections, or do we just have a skewed view of the sexual act in this country?
I think it's a little of each. As the baby boomers are aging, we do see also people are more candid about fessing up to having erectile dysfunction. But this American perseveration on erection isn't absolutely required seems to really be there. And as these drugs got developed, I felt like the marketing of that got more and more severe and absurd.
So in the end here, whether we're married or single with one or a variety of sexual partners, we should be seeking out an enhanced experience with sex, not necessarily an enhanced erection. Better communication and sensuality. This may sound like a feminist stance here, but this is something that works for men just as well for women.
In fact, men who, you know, have only one partner and who report a lot of depth in the relationship in general also do report enhanced sexual experiences, where folks who have multiple partners and don't have the same level of connection often in the long term suggest that their sex is not enhanced. In fact, it's no longer as fulfilling and connecting as it could be.
And there's also that BBC report earlier this year showing that married couples actually have more sex over their lifetime than their single counterparts.
And that's a study that my wife reminds me of often.
Mitch, I want to thank you again for joining us here today. This has been a great topic.
Always a pleasure, Chris.
Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at State University of New York. He's author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book Pot Politics. We have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com. Next up today, we have this portion of an interview I conducted with author Nell Bernstein. Nell's book, All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated, was published last year. This nonfiction book follows in heartbreaking detail the reality of our record prison population and the children left behind as parents and women are increasingly sent behind bars, largely due to prohibition. With speaking with author Nell Bernstein about her new book, All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. Now, how many American children have a mother or father in jail or in prison right now?
Well, 2.4 million kids, or 3 in every 100, have a parent who's currently incarcerated, and 1 in 10 at any given moment has a parent who's incarcerated on probation or on parole.
Now, these kids haven't committed crimes themselves, but they often suffer a form of punishment. What are they suffering out there?
Well, that's something that many kids said to me, that they felt that they had done something. They felt they were being punished. One young woman said, "I feel like my mother was sentenced to spend her life in prison. I was sentenced to grow up without a mother." And that's the primal thing, is the absence of the parent, which, believe me, they feel as deeply as any other child. And then there's all kinds of other sort of corollary effects. Poor kids get poorer, vulnerable kids get more vulnerable.
When parents are arrested, how do the police and the courts treat them?
Well, the amazing thing about the children, given their numbers, is how invisible they are. Several kids told me stories of having police arrest their parents, take them out of the house, and literally leave the children alone. One 9-year-old spent 2 weeks taking care of an infant in that situation. So it's not really a question of them being mistreated so much as them being completely overlooked by these multiple systems that control their parents and so have a huge impact on their lives.
Drug policy has a lot to do with this, as well as mandatory minimums. But there are alternatives to sentences out there. What are some of the good working alternatives you've seen to mandatory minimum sentencing?
Well, in each chapter of the book, I try to kind of outline a piece of the criminal justice system as kids experience it, and then also look at a solution or alternative. And, you know, one program that was really interesting to look at was the Drug Treatment Alternative to Prison program in Brooklyn, which is a program run by the Brooklyn DA's office. So it's a law enforcement instigated program where people who would otherwise be facing long sentences for drug offenses instead are put into intensive residential treatment. You know, and the people who ran that program talked about what it meant to the kids to see Dad in an environment where he was getting help and getting better, rather than seeing him in an orange jumpsuit and handcuffs, most often getting worse.
Now, even getting to visit your parent who is incarcerated can be an expensive and trying process, but many of these parents who are incarcerated do feel that there's an important parental connection to be made. Can you parent from jail?
Yeah, and it's not just that the parents feel it, but that the children feel it, and that researchers have found that when family connections are maintained, kids do better, and parents are less likely to wind up back in prison after they get out. But it's getting harder and harder for kids to get to their parents. The majority of state prisoners now haven't received a single visit from their kids because prisons are increasingly built out in the middle of nowhere.
Now, if there's one thing that we should change about how we treat the children of those we incarcerate, what should it be? What can we do to make a difference?
Well, you know, I think that we have to begin by seeing them. So I think every time we make a decision about law enforcement or sentencing, from arrest through sentencing, through the conditions of confinement, through policy governing prisoner reentry, we should step back for a moment and look at the impact on kids. If that impact is going to be negative, ask ourselves if there's another way to protect public safety, because that's important to kids and to everyone, that would also preserve families. And if there is, I think we need to do that.
We're speaking with Nell Bernstein about her new book, All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated.
Of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana, and over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Strop, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
We have some music for you today here on the Audio Stash. We'll start out with Mikey Dread from the Prime of Mikey Dread album on Dread at the Controls Records. This was found up at the Independent Online Distribution Alliance.
Hi.
That was Mikey Dread from the Prime of Mikey Dread album on the Dread at the Controls Records label, found up at the Independent Online Distribution Alliance. We have links to all of the artists and their CDs we feature on the program at normalaudiostash.com. This has been Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Thanks to Podshow.com for all the great pod-safe music. We feature the band Carne Cruda as our theme. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. Thanks to Red Aphid Interactive Media for the podcasting technology. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow. If you listen to the Audio Stash, cast your vote at Podcast Alley or other podcast directory services. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.